Well, we come to number four in our series, What Kind of God? And tonight, what kind of God allows suffering in the world? Now, it's a warm evening, let's get cracking straight away. And I want to begin by laying down some markers. Okay, what kind of God allows suffering in the world? Number one, God has a plan. So what happens to you and me and everyone doesn't just happen. There's a reason. And the reason, says the Bible, is God's plan. And everything that happens in the universe happens just as God has planned it. So Ephesians 1 verse 11, it happens according to the purpose of him who works all things according to the counsel of his will. Second thing to say is this, God has a big plan. God's control extends over the whole universe. Psalm 135, whatever the Lord pleases, he does. He's accountable to no one. Daniel 4, he does according to his will. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? It's a big plan. God really is God. And God is in control of the natural world. He's in control of the nations. He's in control of the free actions of men and women, boys and girls. And God is in control of every detail of every life. If on your way home you lost 50 pounds, you might tell someone, I've lost 50 pounds. But if on the way home you lost one of the hairs of your head, would you tell anyone? I suppose it depends how many hairs on your head you've got. But a single hair, it's trivial, isn't it? But says Jesus, the very hairs on your head are all numbered. Even the loss of one hair from your head is under God's control. So, number one, God has a plan. Number two, God has a big plan. It covers everything. Number three, just laying down some markers, what about free will? Does God's control eliminate our freedom? No, says the Bible. We're not pieces on a chessboard. So while I'm not free to choose anything outside God's plan, my choices, says the Bible, are nevertheless real, with real consequences for which I will be held responsible. Which, of course, is why when I sin, when I defy God, when I go my own way, I can't blame God. He's not the author of my sin. He doesn't approve of my sin. He doesn't encourage my sin. He doesn't lead me into sin. But my sin is nevertheless in his plan. For though my choices are in his plan, he's planned that they really are free choices. On Sunday mornings, we've been thinking about Jonah. Jonah runs from God. He takes the ship to Tarshish. God sends a storm. To pacify the storm, the sailors throw Jonah overboard. We read, so they picked up Jonah, threw him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. So who threw Jonah into the sea? The sailors threw Jonah into the sea. But then 5 verses later, Jonah says to God, you cast me into the sea. So who threw Jonah into the sea? Was it the sailors or was it God? Well, both are true. The sailors' real choices with real consequences were fulfilling the plan of God. On this piece of paper is an ant. I hope you can see him. And he walks where he chooses. He's a free ant. He can wander where he likes. But by turning the paper, he walks where he chooses. And by turning the paper, he walks where I choose. No one's forcing him. But by turning the paper, he fulfills my will. So God has a plan. God has a big plan. And it's a plan that doesn't eliminate our freedom. But, number four, if God is in control of everything, what kind of God allows suffering? If he's in control, why do bad things happen? And we'll deal with the question through the experience of one man. A man who asked this very question. You probably guessed who he is. His name is Job. So please come with me to the reading which we had in Job, particularly chapter 39. Now, what can we say about Job? Job's a believer, and Job knows all about suffering. In one day, he loses everything. His property, his wealth, his standing, his servants. He even loses his children. And later on, he will lose his health. And Job is more than heartbroken. He is in agony. In the early chapters, when Job at last begins to speak, it's one long, articulate scream, in which Job says, I wish I'd never been born. I want to die. This is a man who loses everything. And to cap it all, it is innocent suffering. Says who? Says God. Job is suffering not because he's guilty of some great misdemeanor. Job is suffering precisely because he is innocent. He suffers not because he is unrighteous, but because he is righteous. And Job knows it. He says to his accusing friends who say to him, look, the reason you're suffering is because of some sin that you're keeping a secret and you haven't confessed it. Job's response to them is, look, of course I'm a sinner. We all are. But not in a way that explains what's happened to me. Why am I suffering when I've done nothing wrong? Says Job in chapter 9, he said, living in God's world is like living in a police state. There you are, you're driving along at 30 miles an hour, minding your own business. The police pull you over. They go through the car. And when they find something, an empty washer bottle, they throw the book at you. That's what God is like. God can always pin something on you. He can always find something of which to accuse you and to make you suffer. And there's no comeback. In chapter 16, Job goes even further. He accuses God of murdering him. Strong stuff. And Job says, look, when God has done me in, let my spilt blood cry out. Let it be a never-ending echo round the courts of heaven as a witness that God has murdered an innocent man. That God has wronged me. Strong stuff. Says Job, what kind of God allows suffering? Suffering to an innocent man. And as you go through the book of Job, Job wants his day in court. He wants God to come and stand in the dock and justify what he's done. He wants God to stand in court and answer the question, why do you allow suffering? Why do you allow this sort of thing to go on? It's strong stuff spoken by the man who has suffered more than any of us in this room. Well, at last in the book, God appears to answer the charges. No, to ask the questions. And as we come to this passage, God is asking Job difficult questions. And they're questions involving decisions about suffering. They're questions about the morality and purpose of suffering. So Job, before you point the finger at me, how would you deal with these issues? Job, you've got lots to say about suffering. How competent are you to judge what is right and what is wrong? What should happen and what shouldn't happen? So have those verses in front of you. And we'll look at those questions. Because they're all questions which relate to this question. What kind of God allows suffering? And we'll call it Job's moral maze. So, question number one. It's a question about the eater and the eaten. See if you can work out what's being asked. So chapter 38, verse 39, God says to Job, can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lurk in their lairs to lie in wait? Who provides food for the raven when his young ones cry to God and wander about for lack of food? Okay, Job, what I want to know is whose side are you on? Are you on the side of the lioness who must feed her cubs? Or are you on the side of her prey? You decide who should live and who should die. And the raven, that's a big black member of the crow family, what does it feed on? Well, ravens feed on dead animals. And if there were no dead animals, if no animals suffered, if no animals died, then the raven's helpless nestlings will die. So come on, Job. God says, come on, everyone. A question about suffering. Should the antelope live and the lion cubs die? Well, if you want the lion cubs to live, well, then the antelope's got to die. One of them's got to suffer. Which will it be? You make the choice. Should the nestlings of the raven feed upon the death of another? What do you think? You decide. Come on, Job. After all, God makes his decisions all the time. Jesus says, Luke 12, God feeds the ravens. Number two, a question about parenting. Look at chapter 39. Do you know the time when the wild mountain goat bear her young? Or can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Or do you know the time when they bear young? They bow down. So they're giving birth now. They bring forth their young. They deliver their offspring. Their young ones grow. Their young ones are healthy. They grow strong with grain. They depart and do not return to them. There's the mountain goat or the deer, and they carry their young for months. That involves a certain amount of strain and suffering. They then bow down and go through the exertion of giving birth. That's suffering. And then next to no time, their young grow up and they leave, never to return. And if you made it into a Disney, everyone would go, oh, shouldn't they stay with their mother a bit longer? Or at least sort of stay around the home and be part of the wider family? Or should they just be allowed to go and the mother never sees her offspring ever again? It's a decision about suffering, isn't it? Well, number three, a question about usefulness. And God brings to Job two animals. One's a wild donkey and the other's a wild ox. So verse 5, who set the wild donkey free and who loosed the bonds of the onager? It's a species of wild donkey. Whose home I have made the wilderness and the barren land his dwelling. He scorns the tumult of the city, so he keeps away from busy built-up places. He does not heed the shouts of the driver, so you can't tame him, you can't use him. Because if you whip him, he'd just ignore you. The range of the mountains is his pasture, so he keeps away from everybody. And he searches after every green thing. And then the same point is made with the wild ox. Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? See what God is saying? Look, here are these animals. The wild ox, the wild donkey, all that power. They're big, strong animals. But that power, you can't use it. Because they won't be tamed. So Job, should God take away their freedom? And then they'd be useful. But if you take away their freedom, there's the ox. It's got a great big chain round it and you're whipping it. And it's suffering, but it's useful. Is it better that it suffers, but it's useful? Or should God give it its freedom? So it doesn't suffer, but it's useless. Then it's useless. You can't use it. Says God to Job, you decide. You organize their lifestyle. You make that decision about whether they should suffer or not. After all, you've got lots to say about suffering, haven't you, Job? And about the way things should be run. And then you've got to like verses 13 to 18. A question of pride and stupidity. And we meet the ostrich. The wings of the ostrich wave proudly. But are her wings and pinions like the kindly storks? For she leaves her eggs on the ground and warms them in the dust. She forgets that a foot may crush them or that a wild beast may break them. She treats her young harshly as though they were not hers. Her labor is in vain without concern. And why is it like it is? Because God deprived her of wisdom and did not endow her with understanding. When she lifts herself on high, she scorns the horse and its rider. I mean, Job is fantastic poetry. But he says, look at the ostrich. There she is, sort of waving her feathers around like some exotic dancer. But she doesn't use her feathers and use her wings in a loving way. Doesn't use them to protect her eggs. Doesn't use them to guard her chicks. She leaves her eggs on the ground where they can be trodden on. And she treats her young really quite harshly. More suffering. And why does she do that? Well, says God, because I've made her stupid. I've made a bird that's stupid, says God. She can outrun the hunter, but she can't keep her eggs safe. So should God give her more sense? So she takes better care of her young? But if she takes better care of her young, it makes her more vulnerable, doesn't it? Makes her more vulnerable to the hunter. So there's more suffering for the ostrich. Or maybe God should give her bigger wings so she can fly and she can make her nest in a tree. But if he did that, then she wouldn't be an ostrich, would she? She'd be something else. She wouldn't be this proud, carefree ostrich. It's questions about suffering. And says, God, what would you do? And then number five is a question of power. And we come to the war horse. Verse 19, have you given the horse strength? Have you clothed his neck with thunder? Can you frighten him like a locust? His majestic snorting strikes terror. It's fantastic poetry, isn't it? He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He gallops into the clash of arms. He mocks at fear and is not frightened, nor does he turn his back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him, the glittering spear and javelin. He devours the distance with fierceness and raging. See his horses galloping across the distance, can't you? Nor does he come to a halt because the trumpet is sounded. At the blast of the trumpet, he says, aha! And he smells the battle from afar, the thunder of captains and shouting. Very evocative, isn't it? Here's this war horse, this great, big, powerful animal, and it's fearless. And it's frightening, and it's aggressive, and it's arrogant, and it's so difficult to control. And once his blood's up, once he's scented the smell of battle, there's nothing you can do to stop him. Once you set him in the right direction, he's off. You can't stop him. He's so difficult to control. But the blast of the trumpet, he says, aha! What says God? Should we tone him down? I mean, a horse like that, you're never going to give rides to children, are you? It's hopeless. Should we tone him down, make him gentler, more user-friendly, more child-orientated? Because he'd be a lot less trouble. Well, fine, but then he'd be no good as a war horse, would he? He'd be great in peacetime, but useless in war. So we can have 9 years of peace and tranquility and ease with this docile, child-friendly horse. But the 10th year, when it's war and you need him, he's useless. And we all suffer. Or shall we have 9 years of trouble and suffering with this great brute who can't be controlled? But the 10th year, when it's war, how thankful we are that we have a war horse who can save us from suffering. And then finally, number six. A question of suffering or serenity. Verse 27, does the eagle mount up at your command, make its nest on high? On the rock it dwells and resides, on the crag of the rock and the stronghold. From there it spies out the prey, its eyes observe from afar. Its young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there it is. Have you seen an eagle soaring? It's such a sight, isn't it? It's wonderful. It's master of all its surveys, and it makes its home in an impregnable fortress up in the rock. But what's it doing when you look at that eagle just gliding through the air? What's it doing? Well, it's actually looking for prey. Verse 30, its young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there it is. So Job, a question. Do you want bunny rabbits to live in safety and to die in peace, to be taken by gentle old age? Or do you want to see an eagle soar? But if you want to see an eagle soar and go, wow, you've got to know, Job, that the bunny gets it. Which is it going to be? You decide. And Job's response, chapter 40. Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. Come on, Job, I'm asking these questions. You are finding fault in my dealings with you. You're asking the question, what kind of God allows suffering? You think I've got a case to answer? You want me to take the stand and answer questions about justice and suffering and whether something is right and wrong? Well, says God, you answer these questions first. Not the moral government of the universe, not the really big moral questions about suffering. I'm just going to give you a few simple starters for 10. Who should live? Who should die? The young lions or their prey? Which one of them is going to suffer, Job? You make the decision. And what about, what are you going to do with the young mountain goat or the deer who go through all that trouble and pain and labor and then they're simply abandoned by their young? And the wild donkey, the wild ox, should they be free and useless? Or should they be chained and suffer, but actually they're very useful? What are you going to do with the ostrich? You're going to make her wiser. If you make her wiser, you make her more vulnerable, and she'll suffer. And what about the warhorse? All that power, but mixed with arrogance and fierceness. So hard to handle in peacetime. But in time of war, how thankful you are there's a warhorse. And the eagle. Would the world be better off without eagles? What do you think? There'd be less suffering, and there'd be less bloodshed. What do you think? Is God wrong to make these creatures? Is he wrong to endow them with qualities that necessitate suffering? Can we navigate the moral maze? Can we look at what God is doing in these simple questions and think, well, I can run the universe better? Would life be better if you and I were in charge? Do you see? Through these simple questions, you see what God is saying. He's saying it to Job, he's saying it to you and me. He's saying, look, this is a world of suffering, where suffering serves a wider purpose. Where of necessity, if one lives, then another must die. And Job is picking it up, and he answers God, verse 4, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further. The man who has experienced suffering at God's hand more than any of us, he clamps his hand over his mouth. He says, I'm not going to say any more. He's beginning to see a bigger picture. He's beginning to realize that the moral universe doesn't end at my front door. There's a bigger picture, a bigger plan. And if Job can't explain these easy questions about suffering, I mean, no one's going to lose any sleep over a few cracked ostrich eggs, are they? But if he can't answer the easy questions about suffering, about the animals, why then should Job, why then should any of us expect to understand God's purposes, not just in his suffering, but for all suffering? What kind of God? Well, Job's jumped in, hasn't he? He's jumped to a conclusion. He wants God to come and give a response. But now, having met with God, Job says, I didn't realize what I was talking about. And if you follow through the book of Job, Job discovers actually there's another answer. When it comes to the question of suffering, there's actually another answer. An answer that's not found in explanations that make sense to me, where all the equations balance. I say, oh, yeah, now I see. There's an explanation which is different. And it's found in trusting the God who has the big plan. The God who is love. The God whose big plan is actually the best of all worlds. And that's why Job begins to see there's another wisdom in this. Not in answers, but in this. Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to depart from evil is understanding. Well, let's draw it all together. It's a warm evening. Time to wind things up. What kind of God allows suffering? Why has God made us like he has? Some people are ostrich-like. They're proud, and they're stupid, and they trample all over us. Some people are warhorses. 90% of the time, they're almost impossible to live with. They're such hard work. But then 10% of the time you realize why they're there. And you're so thankful that they're around. Some people are like the wild donkey or the wild ox. They could be so useful. They're so gifted. They have so much going for them. But you can never pin them down. You can't rely on them. Some people are like the young of the wild goat or the deer. You wear yourself out helping them. You pour yourself into them. And then they clear off without so much as a thank you. And we all meet those people, don't we? You probably think, I've met those people in Amiens Park. I'm sure you've met those people somewhere in your life. Why? Why is it that God has made us with wonderful qualities and destructive qualities in the same person? Qualities which appear to be pulling us in different directions. So that we can bless or we can destroy. And why has God planned my life as he has? Now we know some things are our own fault, but not everything. Why has God planned my life to include suffering? And why are my gains at another's expense? Even at a simple level, you get a job, you say, yeah, I've got a job, but then somebody else hasn't got a job. Why do I have experiences that I can never forget and experiences which I wish I could forget? Why has God made a world of suffering? And like Job, we find ourselves, don't we, in this moral maze. We can't even begin the easy starters for 10. Now, the Bible says at the judgment, where everything is revealed, at the judgment where everything is put right, at the judgment where justice is seen to be done, then God will be vindicated. And every accusation, every question, every finger that's ever been pointed will be answered. And God will be seen to have been perfect and wise and just in all his ways. Because there is a wonderfully wise explanation for why there is suffering in this world. But as Job is beginning to realize, you need the mind of God to understand it. All God's equations balance, but you need the mind of God to understand them. Only God can explain God. Only God can explain his ways. That's where Paul is brought at the end of Romans 11. He says, oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments. And his ways are past finding out. Says Paul, I'm left open mouth. I don't know what to say. Because his ways are unsearchable. That being so, as Job is told, my business is to trust and obey. My business is to love and worship the God I cannot explain. The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. But the book of Job is not God's last word on the subject. In this series, What Kind of God? What have we been finding out? We're really preparing ourselves for this autumn series we're going to get to grips with. Each time we ask the question, what kind of God, we're brought to this point where he is the God who has entered our world. And he's entered this world as a man. He left his fingerprints on cups. He left his footprints in the sand. He left his blood on the ground. Because he entered this world of suffering. And says the Bible, he has suffered as no one has ever suffered. We sang a hymn, Man of Sorrows. It's a title given to Jesus Christ in the Bible. He became a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. So whatever we've been through, this is the God who in Christ has been there before. And much, much worse. And therefore he's the God who sympathizes, the God who knows, the God who understands. So in all our griefs and sorrows and tears, and it's not making sense, that we can fall upon the kind arms of one who does know. And who can help and comfort us in our sorrows and our sufferings as no one else can. But God in Christ has gone further still. What did Job's moral maze teach us? This is a world of suffering, where suffering serves a wider purpose. Where of necessity, if one lives, another must die. And so Jesus Christ, the only perfect innocent, became the greatest sufferer in the universe. And his suffering served the widest purpose of all. The redemption of the world, and ultimately the end of all suffering. Where of necessity, if we are to live, we who've walked out on God, we who've gone our own way, if we are to be saved from sin and death and hell, if we are to live, then of necessity, Jesus must die. So wicked men, by their own free actions, took Christ and nailed him to a cross. But it was all in the big plan. And there he suffered. He suffered as no one has ever suffered. But it wasn't the nails. The soul of his suffering was the suffering of his soul. Nailed to a tree, where he who knew no sin was made to be sin. Where the Holy One took his identity from sin. And he suffered all that sin deserves. That day, when he bore the sin of the world in the presence of the Holy God, and God did not spare his Son, he banished him to the furthest reaches of reality and beyond, to suffer under the curse of God, to burn in the wrath of God, to be banished from the presence of God, where the only word is why. He suffered as no one has ever suffered. My God, why? 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 Why have you forsaken me? No one has ever suffered like Jesus. And yet his sufferings gladden the hearts and gladden the eyes of God's people and will do for the ages to come. Because if we must live, he must die. His suffering serving the greatest purpose of all, the redemption, the salvation of the world. He did it for us. At the cross, all my sin on Jesus laid. Mine the debt, his the cost. By his blood the price is paid. And through his suffering, that fragrant offering, arms of love are opened wide. At the cross, there is healing. At the cross, he suffers that we might live. Peter puts it like this, for Christ suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God. Do you see what God has done through innocent suffering? You see what God has done through the death of his innocent son upon the cross? And what God has done through innocent suffering will be the theme, the song of heaven for the endless ages to come. So as we wind it up tonight, you've seen all the Facebook pictures, haven't you? What do? They get their thing and they take a photograph of themselves, don't they? And they get their best pose and that's all you see just then. And we all do it, don't we? We all put ourselves in the center of the picture. And it's very easy in a suffering world where we suffer to turn the camera on ourselves and take a picture and say, why me? I put myself at the center of everything, just as Job was doing. Job realized actually there was a much bigger picture. Don't do that. Don't turn the camera on yourself. Turn to Jesus Christ. Begin there. Get yourself right with this glorious God of love, the God who has a big plan, and you're part of that plan. And the suffering is part of that plan. And if you hear it right, it's to bring you to himself. To bow the knee. Lord, you died that I might live. You became a man of sorrows that you might wipe every tear from my eyes. I'm beginning to get it. I begin to see. I begin to understand. So Lord, save me. And change me. And forgive me. I don't want to be the center. Turn it round. Christ, bow the knee. Give yourself to him. What kind of God allows suffering in the world? He's the kind of God who sends his son to suffer, to save the world. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life.